Join the conversation.
Join the conversation.
You're with Cape Talk.
Better late than never. Rebecca Davis with Plan B. Hello.
Hello, John.
How is Rebecca?
You know, I have a cold that the internet tells me half the world now has, as things are progressively starting to open up and we're all getting a bit lax about, I don't know, smooshing each other's hands and faces and stuff, even though I don't think I have been, but apparently this is a thing, particularly virulent cold. So as we open up, people, keep your masks on, if not for COVID, because you don't want to catch this.
Okay, the extraordinary story about the taking hostage, and I found it amazing how nobody in government has said they're very bad people, they shouldn't have done it. They all, oh, we're really sorry for you, and don't worry, we'll take your, we never felt in any real danger, and we'll take your concerns seriously, and my goodness, we'll look into it, rather than doing what some law and order fundamentalists would want them to do, throw them all in jail.
Well, they are facing charges, John, because Tony Modise said, not unlike a strict headmistress, they must face the consequences of their actions. But I agree, it has been a sort of paternalistic, maternalistic approach to these 56 people who took the three of the most senior politicians in our country hostage. Just an extraordinary story, which once again one feels really is a South African classic. But my question, which was echoed, I saw, by a number of other journalists, was where were the bodyguards of these ministers? And it's since come out in the press conference they gave today, unsatisfying as it was, that the protectors, as they call them, were very much there, that they were in the room. But yet again, much as happened with the July riots, the ministers paid great tribute to the restraint shown by these protectors in terms of not opening up a can of violence on the hostage takers, but apparently just standing back and letting them do their thing. Well, this is interesting, John, because the Freedom Front Plus released these astonishing figures this week that I had to really rub my eyes. I'm still not sure about them. But the Freedom Front Plus claims that as a result of a question posed by the party in the National Council of Provinces, Minister Tele of the police revealed that the budget for VIPs amounted to 18 million per protected person per year. 18 million per VIP per year. John, I have tried everything to make that figure work. As someone who is not very good at maths, I mean, apparently we're looking at about 6 bodyguards per VIP, and VIPs can be anyone from ministers to MECs, who are the provincial ministers, sometimes MMCs, even allowing for replacements for overtime for someone to do admin. I could not get an 18 million rand per person per annum figure to work unless they were being paid a lot more than the president. Then the DA rather confusingly came out with a statement saying they'd asked the question, and the answer was that it was 8 million per person per annum. That sounds a bit more plausible to me. But nonetheless, John, nonetheless, in the instance where we, the taxpayers, the citizens of this country, are funding VIPs to be protected to the tune of at least 8 million rand per year, while we make two with police protection amounting to about 1,500 rand per person per year, is not the least we could hope for, John, I ask with tears in my eyes, that our ministers not be taken hostage in Irene.
I bet if you were to ask most South Africans, how much would you be prepared to pay to protect the three cabinet ministers that were taken hostage yesterday, the figures would be on the low side and rather embarrassing.
They would, John. And also, I should mention that some politicians, in addition, apparently have dedicated food tasters. I learned this from reading Imran Kabadia's book, The Poisoners. I don't know if you've read it yet.
I have. I thought it was amazing.
It was an amazing book, but you might recall there's that anecdote that the book starts with, that the former KwaZulu-Natal MEC of Health, Peggy Nkunyani, was once at a health banquet and had her personal food taster was nowhere to be found. So her bodyguards went on the street and got street children in to taste her food in order to make sure that it was not poisoned. As horrific as that anecdote is for many, many reasons, it also does suggest that MECs are employing food tasters in addition to their personal security squads, John. There's a lot of job creation happening, it seems.
You ask me, am I curious to know how exactly the ANC is campaigning for these elections? And it's more a case of I know I must be interested rather than I genuinely am, but I am genuinely interested in your experiences of campaigning in the Karoo, which is what you've been watching and doing over the last few days.
I have. I've been in the Central Karoo in the Prince Albert municipality, which takes in Prince Albert and Klaarstroom and Leeuwhamka. John, I actually was interested to know how the ANC is campaigning, because in a situation where the country is clearly falling to pieces, where everything to do with local government seems to be going down the tubes, there's no infrastructure, service delivery is basically at a halt. I was just curious to see, what do the ANC activists on the ground, those persons, not the Ramaphosas or the, you know, the top elite of the ANC, but these activists who have to go door to door, what do they say to people when people say, why on earth should I vote ANC when I have this, you know, river of sewage, when I haven't got a chance at a job, etc.? Well, the answer I can see from my observations of campaigning in the small town Karoo is that what ANC activists remind the community, and that I had access to a kind of cheat sheet of talking points for these ANC activists, that they remind them, first of all, that the job opportunities they're given by the Extended Public Works Project and Community Works Program come to them from the ANC. So in these small towns, you'll see almost everyone is wearing orange overalls because they are given these contract jobs to do things like pave the streets or dig holes or whatever. You know, it really is job creation of a sort, that they're working on infrastructure projects. People in the communities take turns, effectively, to have these jobs. We give them income, not very much, but 100 rand a day for a couple of months, and then everyone swaps. So they're reminded, those jobs are from the ANC. They're also reminded, the COVID grant, the 350, which actually, John, is a huge boon to many hungry and poor South Africans, COVID or no COVID. I mean, this was more money than anyone had had before. That came to you from the ANC. Social grants come to you from the ANC. And food parcels that you got during COVID came to you from the ANC. So the suggestion is effectively that without the ANC, you will lose access to all those things and your lives will be even more miserable and poorer than they were before. You know, there's a lot spoken about that, how come this silly electorate keeps voting for the ANC in such numbers. But I think when you are presented with facts like that and you are truly in desperate situations, that it's plausible that fear of losing those things will lead you to vote for the ANC once more. And the onus really is on opposition to make a plausible case that you will not lose those things if an opposition comes to power, but in fact be granted greater benefits and great opportunities.
I mean, they would all argue, Rebecca, that that's exactly what they are doing, that they will give more and give more less corruptly, which means even more will be given. But it's not a message that is landing in places like Prince Albert and Leeuwhamka.
I think it's also the case, and the DA representative in that municipality said as much, that the DA, for instance, is targeting its message at such different sectors that it's hard to come up with a coherent message. The rich middle class do not need to hear the same things as the poor. You know, the poor want to hear about social grants, expansion, and community work projects, and the middle class wants to hear that, you know, the streets are going to be kept clean and their dustbins are going to be emptied regularly. So it is hard, and there has to be a lot of kind of segmentation in campaigning when you do go door to door. Look, I feel for everyone. You know, I think that elections are difficult, and I think that politics in general just uses a phenomenal amount of money that we could be spending, all of us, elsewhere. But it is true that when people are desperate, the most, I think the most proximate appeals are the ones that are likely to be most successful.
Are you a time millionaire? I don't think I am.
I'm not. I'm not a time or a money millionaire, John, which I think is the worst of all worlds, right?
Yes.
I mean, the question is, if you have all the money in the world, I mean, I know some people like this, but you have absolutely no time to spend it, what good does that do you, really? You're just working and working for, I suppose, a retirement date, and when it comes, you may find yourself too infirm to enjoy it. Well, apparently, in the UK and the US now, they're facing basically a labor crisis, and I've read this in several places, because of the enforced lockdown and the enforced kind of idleness in some situations of the pandemic led many people to believe that really they were working too hard, they were working too many hours in particular, and what needed to be cherished was time as well as money. And it is true, John, of course, that we are encouraged to focus on the money in our bank account as a measure of our success, and not the amount of hours we have in the day. In fact, if we have a lot of hours available to us in the day, we're really seen as idle, as lazy, as people who are not being productive. And that's something that we need to fill as soon as possible. And you might recall all the advice during lockdown that we should be learning a new language and, you know, cultivating
board games. That didn't go well.
It didn't go well, John. Point is, many people are now waking up to the idea of reducing their hours and their income at the same time, because money, it turns out, is only one measure of wealth. Another one is how much time you have and what you can do with it. And I think that that is actually a valuable point. They do make the point as well, this is from a long-form article in The Guardian, that this applies mainly to child-free members of the professional classes, as do so many of these trend articles. Because, of course, if you are very poor, working on minimum wage, there is no way you are reducing your hours, because what are you going to do with it other than worry about where your rent is coming? But for those who do have the luxury of reducing hours spent working for time, perhaps you should start considering that time as a resource in its own right as well as money.
I don't like fur babies. It makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. But I like it more than I like a new trend. Gardeners calling themselves plant parents. No, Rebecca. No. This must stop straight away.
John, I'm pretty sure that your old expert gardeners, those your listeners there in the deep south, your Keith Kirstens, would vomit at the thought of calling themselves plant parents instead of gardeners, or just people who do a bit of gardening. But plant parents, John, is what millennials with plants call themselves. And as evidence, I sent you a recent News 24 article to prove that this is a thing in South Africa too. Now, because I am someone who loves to present you with hard facts and research, I used the Google Ngram tool just before I came online, John, to try to determine when this term first came into popular culture. And I can tell you it did not exist until 2019. There are no references to it before then. I think it sort of coincided just with the onset of lockdown, in fact, that millennials suddenly decided to adopt, I'm using that term loosely, plants, to acquire plants, to fill their houses with it, because more and more millennials are having kids later. And taking care of a plant provides, I'm told, a sense of purpose and fulfillment, which they might otherwise be getting from a child or a dog, but they live in small flats and aren't allowed dogs, and they're only going to have kids when they're 50 because technology will allow it. And so what are they? They are plant parents, John. Now, my question is, and you know, this is a very widespread use. If you go onto social media, I mean, you'll be confronted with people unashamedly calling themselves plant parents all over the show. What happens when your plant baby dies, as mine inevitably do? Is there a greater sense of grief, John, because you are no longer a human mourning a plant that you didn't look after well enough? You are now a parent grieving the loss of your offspring.
My offspring.
How does it work?
My offspring onion. Yeah.
I would like to hear from your listeners if any of them are plant parents. What is it about this term that they like? Does it express something about their relationship with their plants that older generations are too unsentimental, perhaps, to feel so deeply?
Thank you, Rebecca Davis. I hope we'll have Plan B on Thursday next week. But pre-election, these things are flexible and fluid.